Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week on The Reading Life, Jasmine Ward, whose new novel is Sing, Unburied, Sing. It is such a pleasure to welcome Jasmine Ward back to The Reading Life. We have so much to talk about this time. Her recently announced MacArthur Fellowship, her wonderful new book, Sing, Unburied, Sing. She's also the author of the novels Where the Line Bleeds and Salvage the Bones, the memoir Men We Reaped, and the editor of the 2017 anthology The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race. Jasmine is also an associate professor of English at Tulane University. So Jasmine, I'm so happy to see you.
It's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
MacArthur. So now this is something every American dreams about.
Yes.
You know, everybody posts on Facebook. They passed me by again this year. So just for the thrill of it all, just tell us how you got the news.
They called me around a month ago.
Oh, you've had to keep this a secret.
Yes. Uh-huh. They called me around a month ago and they said, sit down. And they told me the news. And I was speechless because I had no idea. And it's a big deal, right? I mean,
huge.
Like you said, like every American wants a MacArthur Fellowship. So, yeah, so it was crazy. And then they tell you, basically, they tell you you can't tell anyone.
Right.
So then that's difficult, too, because you're just sort of sitting on it. But you know that this great thing has happened.
And you know your life is going to change.
Yes.
You know it.
Yes.
So, you know, you said the other day that it was the gift of time and freedom, which is what every writer wants. Mm-hmm. So have you had time to see how this might change your life?
I don't think that it's clear to me yet, right, exactly how having this award will change my life. I mean, I know that it will, but I don't know exactly yet, like, what the shape of that will be. I mean, I feel like I can already see it somewhat in that it's introducing my work to a lot of people,
yes,
right? And it's like widening my audience. And so that's an immediate effect of it. But yeah, I guess the practical effects, I haven't figured that out yet.
I think the immediate effect might be looking in the mirror and going, damn, I'm a genius. You know what I mean? That might be the immediate fun part of it. But at the same time, this is such a joyful time for you, for all these things to come together, because you're launching Sing Unburied Sing, which is such an amazing book, and you're getting that kind of love for it that I think a writer always hopes to get.
Yeah, definitely. It's been amazing. It hasn't even been out that long. It came out in the beginning of September, but it's gotten a ton of great reviews. It has been long listed and shortlisted for different awards, and people are buying it. Readers are buying it, and they're reading it, and they're loving it. You know, the response to the book is really strong. And sometimes their responses, they have these like very emotional responses. You know, they're writing them and saying, oh, I cried through the last couple of chapters. And I don't think I expected that. It's been lovely. I mean, that's everything that a writer wants, right?
Absolutely. Well, at the very heart of this book is the story of a brother and sister, Jojo and Kayla. Mm-hmm. And that relationship has been central to everything you've written all along. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that the reason that sibling relationships are so important to my work, I think, of course, it stems from my relationship with my brother, especially, but my relationship with my sisters, too. But I do think that my brother, that his loss, I think that definitely, that makes me think about sibling relationships often. And it makes me think about the ways that sibling relationships, the ways that they can help us to survive, the ways that they can nourish us, the ways that they can bind a family together, I think. So yeah, so I think that's why I keep sort of circling that idea and returning to that idea and writing about it in all my work, really, right? Because I've written about it in creative nonfiction. I've also written about it in my fiction. So
Well, JoJo just captures the reader's heart from the very beginning, because here he is, 13 years old, and he's trying so hard to be brave. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that you capture so well and so beautifully is children do have to be brave in this world.
Mm-hmm. And especially in the world that JoJo's been born into, where he does have a family. His grandparents do the best that they can, you know, to take care of him, to nurture him, to raise him. But his mother is not there. And sometimes she's antagonistic. You know, she's like an antagonistic presence instead of a nurturing one. And in many ways, I think that she undermines his childhood. And then, of course, then you have like the pressures of the outside world, right? Of the larger world, who they look at JoJo and they don't see a 13-year-old boy. That larger world doesn't even acknowledge his childhood, right? They don't acknowledge his adolescence to that larger world. I mean, he's nothing but a budding menace.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, he does. He has to be brave.
And he has to be brave in the face of death.
Mm-hmm.
Literally,
mm-hmm.
death. Yep. I mean, that's in the very beginning of this book.
Yeah. Death is a definite presence, right, in the world of the book and in his life. I mean, from the very beginning, he faces that death, right, the goat's death. But then we also know in the first chapter, right, that he's also facing his grandmother's death, right? This mm-hmm. is something that is looming and that he knows that it will descend upon him. So from the very beginning, he's struggling with these issues that are so much larger than him.
That's what I think of when I think of this book is his incredible bravery in the face of the world when he is so small and so young.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things you do so well in writing about the world of these children is that you show how brave they have to be, how close death really is all the time.
No, that's what I was attempting to do. So
yeah. So, and for Kayla, too. I mean, her constant hunger, her constant need. What you want to do with children is give them everything you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you're always reminding us that many children don't get what they need.
Yeah.
So another one of the things that you do so well is render the complexity and the humanity of this family. It's a very interesting family. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about these people and how they came to you.
JoJo came to me first.
I knew it.
He did. I've been wanting to write about JoJo for a really long time. After I finished a rough draft of Salvage the Bones, which was probably in 2009, 2008, that's when JoJo's character, like I was casting about for someone else to write about, and JoJo popped into my head, you know, this 13-year-old mixed-race boy, right, growing up in the rural South. And at first, he wasn't in the situation that he's in Sing Unburied Sing. At first, he was wandering this like post-apocalyptic landscape with an older man who was probably a prototype for Pop. And this post-apocalyptic landscape was actually rural Mississippi, the Gulf Coast, after Hurricane Katrina, like the immediate aftermath of the storm. And his family was all wrong. He had three siblings in the beginning. His mother was white in the beginning. Pop was not in the story in the beginning. So JoJo was who he was from the very beginning, right? So he was this brave boy who is trying to navigate the world and figure out what it means to grow up, what it means to become a man, what it means to become a Black man in the rural South.
Right.
And so from the very beginning, that's who he was, and that's what he was attempting to do. First of all, I had to write Men We Reap. I kept writing like unsuccessful first chapters, where JoJo was the only character who was clear and everyone else around him was not. And I couldn't get any traction. And at the time, I felt like I needed to write Men We Reap. Like that story felt more immediate. Mm-hmm. And so I actually put what would later become Sing Unburied Sing, I put that away, those bad first chapters. I put that idea away and I concentrated on writing the memoir. So it was only after I was done with the memoir that I thought, okay, well, let me return to JoJo and let's see if I can figure out the right entry point, the correct beginning, the see if I could find the right door to open, to walk into his world. So then, and I realized the key to that, right, the key to that door was figuring out who his family members were. And I have to say, like, it was easier to figure out who Pop was, who Mam was, who Kayla was.
I love them.
before Leonie. Leonie was the hardest character for me to get some sort of, like, understanding of as far as her motivation, what drove her. I didn't figure out, really begin to figure out who she was until I was at least like 3 or 4 chapters into Sing.
And we should say that she's JoJo's mother.
Yes, she's JoJo's mother.
She suffers from addiction.
Yes. She suffers from addiction. She neglects her children sometimes. Sometimes she's emotionally abusive to them. Sometimes she's even physically abusive to them. On the surface, she's a very unlikable character. And I think that's one of the reasons that it was so hard for me to figure out what was driving her, because I felt a certain sense of a distaste for her because of how awful she was to these the other characters who are so easy to love from the very beginning,
yes.
Right? As soon as you encounter them on the page, they're easy. You like them. You want to spend more time with them. But I don't think that's necessarily the case with Leonie. And so it wasn't until I figured out that she had a sibling and that her sibling died when they were younger, then I could understand the pain that she was carrying around with her, and also understand how, like, unresolved it was and how she'd never really wrestled with her grief or really learned how to bear it. But once I figured that out, then I was able to sort of understand why she's so self-involved and why it's so hard for her to move past who she is and her own concerns and her own struggles and be a nurturer and be a caretaker to her children and to the other people in her family.
And you give her these moments of seeing JoJo and Kayla together, mm-hmm. and wishing that her children, mm-hmm. would reach for her that,
yeah.
way, and knowing,
yeah.
what she is losing.
Yeah.
And that makes you feel...
One of the most heartbreaking things about her character, she knows that she's failing them and she doesn't want to, but she just can't move past her own pain and her concerns, her love for Michael, her need for that kind of like obsessive love that she shares with him. She just can't see beyond herself, really.
And we should say that Michael is JoJo and Kayla's father.
Yes. And he is in Parchment Prison at the beginning of the novel. And he calls home and he lets Leonie know that he's getting out. And so the novel begins with Leonie packing her kids in the car, packing JoJo and Michaela and one of Leonie's friends in the car, and then they head north to Parchment Prison.
You did lots of research into Parchment, mm-hmm. which is such a strong thread in this,
mm-hmm.
book, the possibility of it,
mm-hmm.
the experience, mm-hmm. of it. And I wonder if you talk about that, because it is something that just looms, mm-hmm. over this story.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me because, you know, I grew up in Mississippi. I did not grow up in the Delta. I grew up on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But even though I grew up on the Gulf Coast, when I was a kid, I knew about Parchment Prison.
Yeah.
And it was this, you know, and I knew that it was a place that I never wanted to end up. Even though I didn't know exactly how awful it was, I didn't know much about the history of the place. But I feel like most children in Mississippi, especially most Black children in Mississippi, know about Parchment when they're growing up. And so I knew about Parchment. But then once I decided to write Sing Unburied Sing, I did. I had to do research about Parchment, because I realized even though I grew up like knowing about the place, I didn't really know much about it. And so one of the most valuable resources for me was a book called Worse Than Slavery,
uh-huh.
By David Oshinsky. And that book is all about Parchment Prison. It's a history of the place. It also is in some respects about Mississippi before Parchment Prison, mm-hmm. which is, it was interesting to read that too, because like I didn't know that Mississippi, when they were wiping out the native populations and then settling in the states that would later become Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama, that Mississippi was known, it was like the Wild West of the South.
Yeah.
It was like a very lawless place. So there was a lot that I learned about Mississippi history, about Parchment Prison, about the fact that around the time that Parchment Prison was established, the laws were changed in the state of Mississippi so that crimes, more like very small crimes that newly freed slaves would commit, were criminalized. And then even some things that weren't crimes were criminalized. So like loitering, vagrancy, these very small things, especially like stealing very small things, food, those things were criminalized, and this was done on purpose, right? So they could populate this prison with mostly black people, black men specifically.
And also children.
And also children.
Young children.
Right? And I didn't know that either. And so when I found out that black boys as young as 12 and 13 were charged with small crimes like that, like vagrancy, loitering, et cetera, and were sent to Parchman Prison to work, to basically to be slaves again, because they were rented out to like industrial barons in the South, right, who used them to clear wide tracts of land to lay the railroad. They were also worked on Parchman Prison, which was basically a large plantation. When I learned that, right, that kids that young were sent to live and die in Parchman Prison, that's when I knew that I had to write about a character like Richie. He's a character in Sing Unburied Sing, right? So he's a kid who was sent to Parchman Prison in the 1940s and who is in Parchman Prison in the 1940s with Pop, who is JoJo's grandfather.
He's one of my favorite characters. Those must have been very hard things for you to write.
It was. It's funny because, I mean, I'm not funny, sort of sad, but each time I get a version, I receive a version of Sing Unburied Sing in the mail, right? So my publishing company will send the advanced review copies and they send the hard covers. And then, so each time I'll open up the book and just start reading a little bit of it. I don't know why I do this, but I do it. And I feel like when I got the hardcover that I opened it up to one of Richie's sections. And I was reading one of the chapters from Richie's point of view, and I actually started to tear up. I got really sad. As I was writing it, I didn't realize that it would have that kind of effect on me. Mm-hmm. But when I went back and read it, you know, each time I go back and read a bit of his story, it's just, I mean, it's heartbreaking, you know, because I know that children like him actually, they existed. They lived and died in that place. Another thing that makes that knowledge so heartbreaking and a character like him so heartbreaking is that he'd been erased from history. I grew up in Mississippi. I knew that Parchman Prison was an actual place, yet I had no idea that children like him were sent to that place and that they died in that place. That's heartbreaking. As I was writing the book, as I was writing his character, I wanted him to have some happiness. I really wanted that for him because he's a child, right?
Right, another child.
He's another child.
His section was the first one I marked when I was reading this book. It's so compelling. And one of the points you make in this book is that the spirit world is always there in the lives of these people. Mm-hmm. The lost are always there. Mm-hmm. I kind of think now in contemporary literature, grief is the great subject. Mm-hmm. Grief is the thing that everyone must reckon with. And you do that on so many layers of experience in this book. Mm-hmm. So many people are dying or haunting or possibly getting lost. Mm-hmm. It is a haunted story in so many ways.
It is. I think part of the reason that I write about death and the experience of grief is, of course, because, you know, because I lost my own brother, right? Mm-hmm. I think before that I was, maybe when I was younger, maybe when I was in my 20s and my early 30s, that I thought a lot about death in relationship to people dying young or dying early, right? And I think now as I get older, that I'm also thinking about what it means to lose someone who is older, right? What it means to lose someone to illness, right? What it means to lose someone in their later years. And so I think that I'm sort of wrestling with all the different
ways.
Yeah. Some of my friends have lost older relatives, and something that I said to one of them when I was younger was that I said, oh, it always feels wrong. Death always feels wrong, whether or not you lose someone when they're very young or whether or not you lose your great-grandmother who's 90 years old. It always feels like something that should not happen, even though it's the thing that's always going to, you know, it always, it's the thing that's always going to happen. You know, as I was writing this book and especially writing about Ma'am, writing about her illness and her struggle with her illness, that's one of the ideas that was in the back of my head, right? This idea
Well, you know, grief is such a combination of, it's an emotional roller coaster ride, and so much of it is anger, and so much of it is love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at your work, and a lot of your work has been propelled by anger. Mm-hmm. You know, Men We Reaped, I think, was, and of course, The Fire this time after the death of Trayvon. Mm-hmm. That was something that was so important and catalyzing for you. Mm-hmm. So what do you feel is the strongest driving force now in Sing Unburied Sing? Do you feel it's the love, or you feel the anger, or what was your emotional feeling? Well, I mean, what was going on in your head?
Oh, Jess, wow, that's a tough one.
No, but you know what I mean? It's like you're torn between these two feelings.
Yes.
And this is a book that is rich in love and rich in anger, too.
That's a really hard question to answer. Like, I don't know if I can answer it well. I mean, I think that is true. Like, one of the strongest emotions that you feel when you're wrestling with grief is that sense of anger and rage, because you're so helpless in the face of it, and because you realize that all you can do is live with this thing. You have no control in that situation, and that's the only proactive thing that you can do, is to figure out how to live with this this loss and with this sort of sadness. And then I think you feel anger too, because you realize that you're going to carry this around for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Maybe that is at the heart of it.
Maybe it's finding the way to honor it.
Yeah.
You know, to honor the loss.
That's true.
You know? Well, the last time I saw you, I have to bring this up. The last time I saw you, you were exuberantly, gloriously pregnant.
Yes.
So now you have a new young man in your life.
Yes.
So can you feel it? Can you feel that you're at the height of your creative powers? Do you feel that kind of energy coming through to you?
I don't know. I do not like to think about it.
Really?
Yeah, because I want to continue. I want to believe that I can continue to grow and mature as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to believe that I haven't hit my peak yet,
right?
And that with every book that I'll get better and better. So because I want to believe that, I try not to think that I'm at some sort of height or some sort of apex right now, right?
Because but isn't it interesting to get that little storm surge of creative energy with new babies, new books?
Yes.
I think writing while you're pregnant is very exciting.
It is. Unless you are struggling with some...
Well, maybe so. The unspeakable.
Yes. You know? Then it can be difficult. I mean, because when I was pregnant with my first child, that's when I was working on... I was writing the rough draft of Men We Reap. It was very difficult because here I was, you know, wrestling with my grief, right? And crying every day, right?
Oh.
As I'm writing, and then I'm pregnant, I'm thinking, what am I doing? I'm feeling all this stress. What if am I affecting my unborn child? But then also, like, wrestling with everything that I was wrestling with on the page, right? And thinking, what is this world that I'm, like, bearing my child into, right? Yeah. And I think I felt some of that, too, because I was working on Sing and Bear Sing while I was pregnant with my son, right? And so in part, right, in Sing and Bear Sing, I'm like wrestling with what it means to be a black boy in the American South, what it means to be a black man in the American South. So I think the subject matter can complicate that joy,
can.
That elation.
Well, at the end of this book, there's such a moment of peace, of exquisite peace, mm-hmm. and a sense of ease.
Mm-hmm.
And home.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, is that something you are feeling in your life now?
I don't know. I mean, in some respects, yes, because right now I've lived in my hometown for around 6 years as an adult, as an artist. And that feels good because it's something that I never thought, or that it's something that I had doubts about, like whether or not I'd be able to accomplish. Right. Whether or not I'd be able to come home and work, you know, and write. I'm really happy that I've made that happen. But you know, my relationship with the South is complicated. Home is complicated. So I'm still struggling, I think, and still, you know, I think about my decision to come home every day. And especially now that I've had kids, I think it changes my ideas about home.
Opens up a whole new vista on the world. Well, you put so much beauty into the world, Jessamine, and we are all grateful. We've been talking with Jessamine Ward, the newly minted MacArthur Fellow and the author of Sing, Unburied Sing. Jessamine, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Walter Isaacson discusses and signs Leonardo da Vinci. Tuesday, November 21st at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, presented by Octavia Books. Thursday, December 7th from 4 to 6 for high tea and cocktails at Words and Music at the Hotel Monteleone. Tickets available at Falk House, F-A-U-L-K House, at AOL.com. Isaacson also appears Monday, December 11th at 6:30 at the New Orleans Advocate. Ann Powers of NPR Music discusses and signs her new book, Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music, Tuesday, November 21st at 6 at the Old U.S. Mint. Saturday, November 25th is Small Business Saturday. You'll find area authors hand-selling their favorite books in local indie bookstores. Check it out. I'll be working at Octavia Books. The Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the LEH, presents Nancy Dixon, Jack Davis, Freddie Evans, and Allison Fensterstock, discussing and signing New Orleans and the world, 1718 to 2018, the Tricentennial Anthology, Wednesday, November 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Bloodjet Poetry Series presents poetry with Henry Goldkamp and Alina Stefanescu, reading their work Wednesday, November 29th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. If it's November, it's National Novel Writing Month, which sets writers on the path of writing a 50,000-word novel by November 30th. The Lakeshore Branch Library, 1000 West Esplanade, hosts writing sessions from 5 to 8:30 every Monday in November. Shannon Kitchens facilitates. All during November, the Tulane University Library presents an open book, Recent Rare Acquisitions, an exhibit of rare books on the sixth floor of Howard Tilton Memorial Library that runs through November 30th. And Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, takes place December 6th through 10th with featured guests Walter Isaacson, John Gregory Brown and Carrie Brown, Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, and Jeff Kleinman and Deborah Grosvenor, among others. For information and to register, check out wordsandmusic.org. The 16th Annual New Orleans Book Fair takes place Saturday, December 9th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Cluett Gardens, Cluett and Royal Street. Tubby and Coos Mid-City Bookshop is partnering with local author Bill Lofelm for three fiction writing workshops in December, the first three Saturdays from 2 to 4 at the bookshop. Classes are capped at 15 students. Contact Bill Lofelm directly at nolabill@cox.net for registration or tuition information. And a big shout-out to Lady Hubbard, recipient of the 2017 Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence for her debut novel, The Talented Ripkins. Now in its 11th year, the Gaines Award is a nationally acclaimed $10,000 prize given annually by the Baton Rouge Area Foundation donors. It recognizes outstanding work from rising African-American fiction writers and honors Louisiana native Ernest Gaines' extraordinary contributions to the literary world. The award will be presented to Hubbard at 6:30 p.m. on January 18th at the Manship Theater at the Shaw Center for the Arts in downtown Baton Rouge. Doors will open at 6. The ceremony is free and open to the public, although reservations are requested at gainesaward@braf.org. And here we are heading into the holidays this Thanksgiving week. This week also marks the 7th anniversary of The Reading Life, and we look forward to our 8th year welcoming producer George Ingmire. Thanks for listening and writing, and most of all for reading. New Orleans is a wonderful literary city, and you all are an important part of that. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmire and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.